This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Today on Dreamland, we're going to be doing something that's both very old, and in fact, older than you can probably imagine, and very new. But before we start, I'd like to go over some things about last week's show. Obviously, a lot of you saw me struggling, and I put that there for a reason, and that is that you have to understand it's a struggle to do what I do. Always with the visitors, when I write a book, some level doesn't want it written, and another level does. And, you know, we wonder why they never land. I think they never land because they're fighting each other so hard. There is definitely conflict. And those of us who are in the middle of this are victims of that conflict. And that happened. And I struggled. But I'm not struggling now. I feel fabulous. And I'm ready to go. And boy, do we have a show for you today. I was simply blown away by this book that I got a hold of from Inner Traditions called Sorcerers of Stone. And we're going to now meet the sorcerer herself who created this marvelous book. Good morning,
Thank you. Camille. Thank you, Whitley. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here with you today. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Okay, for folks, she's going to be sort of jumping around a bit because she's in Peru, in Cusco, and there's no point in trying Zoom or anything because they'll all be like this. But you can hear her beautifully, and so don't worry about the fact that the video starts and stops a bit. Okay, Sorcerers of Stone. I think the best place to start, I've got so many questions here. Look at this. You know, people think podcasters don't read the books. This guy, he reads the books and loves them. And I don't put on books I don't find fabulous. So anyway, let's start. Camille, give us a little bit of background, of your background. I mean, you've written one of the most remarkable books about the lost past I've ever read. I mean, it's right up there with and beyond, in some respects, the great Graham Hancock books. And it's incredible. So how in the world, where did you come from, my friend?
Well, comparing me to Graham Hancock is like I don't even think I'm near that, but thank you very much. I landed in Peru about 13 years ago, and I fell in love with the culture, and I fell in love with the Cusco and the great walls that you see all around Cusco, the dancing that was happening at Inti Raymi, which is usually around June 23rd. It was just such a vibrant culture. And I knew that one day, I was only here for a couple weeks, and I knew I would come back because I was just fascinated with Peru. And it was only until like 5 years ago I came back, and I was only here for about 5 months. I had an extended visa. And I went back to Hawaii at that time where I was living. I was living in a Yogananda community on the Big Island called Polestar Gardens. And I happened to be caught up in the volcano that was erupting at that time. And basically, I kind of fled to California. And I said, why am I here in California? You know, it's so expensive. It's, when my heart lies in other places. And I knew I wanted to get back to Peru. So I ended coming back to Peru in 2019. And I got caught up in the pandemic. And that gave me a lot of time to really explore the territory and look at the sites that were really in my vicinity, like Sacsig Woman, Olete Tambo, Nyapa and Glacia, and spent a lot of time really examining them. And I was noticing things that didn't really make sense when I went with guides who were telling me, oh, this was the Inca who built this, or the Quilque built this. But I noticed like three very, very different styles, you know, that were up there. And there was a style that I later found out was called by Alfredo Gamarra. It was called Hanampacha. And this was a style of construction that was actually below the megalithic sites that we see here in Peru. And it looked so weird and just so strange that it just didn't make sense to me. And when I went with guides and locals, you know, they were saying, well, the Inca built this along with the other styles, the megalithic style and the later styles. And they just seemed too incongruent to really, you know, make sense of. And so I really started looking for other explanations about what I was actually witnessing up there. And I came across the work of Jean-Peter Dejean and his website, I think Mysteries Explained. And he went into the theories of this Alfredo Gamarra and how he was explaining these three particular different styles in Sacsig Woman in the environs around Cusco. So I started exploring Gamarra's theories, and it also led me down a rabbit hole to also look into you know, Rudolf Steiner's work on early man and Madame Blavatsky's work and what they were saying about early humanity at that time. And I found a lot of correspondences in what they were seeing through the Akashic records and through spiritual meditation techniques and basically, you know, how they were seeing things like early humanity manipulating stone quite easily. There was a different type of atmosphere at that time, which made it easier for them to actually manipulate the stone. And these things were corresponding also with Alfredo Gamarra's work, which was saying that the Earth had a different atmosphere at that time. Gravity, there was less gravity in the world.
The planet was physically smaller.
And that's what he was saying.
Well, here's an interesting thing. Tell us about that paper that you quote from about the size of the planet. I thought that was absolutely fascinating because it's not something that conventional wisdom would agree with at all. But and yet there's really good evidence for it.
Yeah, it does seem like at one time, I mean, if you look at how the continents are shaped and, you know, it does seem like at one time they were actually, you know, it was one landmass. And I guess you could say that's Pangaea. But Pangaea basically really talks about it being on one side of a Earth that is the same size that we have today. So what various, you know, scientists have looked at in the past, and I believe even Tesla and Galileo, Newton, was that they thought at one time the Earth could have been smaller, and as it was expanding, the continents were breaking up and spreading, and you know, it seems like that could be a possibility. And if you have a smaller Earth with a smaller mass, it would seem like gravity would also, we would be under less gravitational forces. Right.
Yeah. The paper I was referring to is David Noel's paper. Perhaps it slipped your mind under the pressure that happens. It's called, folks, David Noel. It's the Ben Franklin Center for Theoretical Research in Australia, and it is called Continental Drift and Earth Expansion. And it is really a fascinating paper because it gives you an entirely different vision of what the past of this planet may have been like. And I think that since it's clear to any of us who look at the past with any kind of real open mind, the past of mankind was very different. Now, let me ask you now another question. It seems a perfect time for this question to come in, which is, and we're going to take a break before you answer, so take a breath. Humans were different in constitution in the past. This is critically important, I think. Mm-hmm. Right. They could do different things. They had different powers. They lived in a different way and in a different world. And we're in trouble in our world because we don't have their powers. So I want you to tell us a little bit when we come back about their different powers and their different world. We'll be right back. We're talking to Camille Sauvé. Her book, her remarkable book, Sorcerers of Stone. She has a website, sorcerersofstone.com, where you can explore articles and get in contact with her if you have questions. I'm sure she'll answer them. This book is really extraordinary. Before we left the air, I asked the question about the humans of the past being different in constitution. And yeah, there's a lot of material in the book about this that I found quite fascinating. Can you talk about it a little bit?
Yeah, basically, I was referring a lot of the work of Madame Blavatsky, basically her Secret Doctrine, Volume 2, Anthropogenesis, really speaks to how human beings at one time were more spiritual. As we became, and as the Earth began to materialize, human beings actually started materializing with humans, and this is part of the doctrine of theosophy. So, this is also what Rudolf Steiner also speaks about, that humans were. We seeded this earth like many eons ago. Perhaps it went in our more spiritual state. This could have been back hundreds of millions of years. So
when you say a more physical state, you're literally suggesting that we were not as dense physically as we are now.
Yeah, I think the word they describe it as more plasticine. There was a time where we were more like of a gaseous substance, and over a period of millions of years, we started to come to the state that we are today, which is our forms today, but
extremely physically complex and very dense.
Right.
Like over-designed machines.
Yes. And that also came, we evolved with Earth in that respect, that we were, the gas, the Earth was at one time a gas planet, and then it started to congeal. Humans were also involved with this evolution with Earth. So we were really part of of this planet.
This is such an important concept, because initially when you hear this with a Western mind, you think, oh no, that can't be true. But when you think of it differently, that we have always been part of the planet. We are part of the Earth. And in my life, the more I have come to accept and bring that into my consciousness and my reality, the deeper my journey has become and the more profoundly connected to the Earth it has become. We became disconnected from the Earth somehow. Mm-hmm. Right. But before we go on, I want to go back to the early Is it Hanapacha? What is the earliest?
Yes, those were, there were actually three different terms that Alfredo Gamarra describes for the archaeology around, not only around Peru, but you can see these forms like everywhere around the world.
In the world. In the world, folks.
Yes.
This is not just Peru. This was a world-girdling civilization, and the illustration, some of the illustrations in the book are going to shock you, because you can see that this strange ability to shape stone and stuff wasn't limited to Peru at all. But what I wanted to make is this. You mentioned in the book the Inca Empire lasted, what, from about, it ended when the Spaniards came, but it started in, what, about 600 AD?
That's what they call the imperial, Inca. There was also, they believe there was a pre-imperial Inca period. That was probably around 1200 CE time. And this was a period that really started from the Tiwanaku area. And there was a group of people, with the Inca royal leadership coming from that area. And they established, according to conventional history of pre-Columbia, they established Cusco. And it was around the time of...
You make a point that they could not possibly have built all of this in that time. It's just said that it's all Inca. They say that because we don't they don't understand, and they dismiss it. It's dismissing. It's typical of Western Eurocentric thinking. They dismiss the past. They don't explain it. They dismiss it.
Right.
And that's dismissing the past to say that these people could do this impossible thing.
Yeah, and there's been a few professors of pre-Columbian, history who basically said what happens here in Peru is they try to fit archaeological evidence into a historical narrative, and they try they basically give the huacas, which are called the sacred sites here. Attribute them to certain Inca kings because they often had a priest class that did ceremonies and oracle readings for the Inca priest. And that is why archaeology sites tend to get associated with the Inca Empire, even though these things are much, much older than the Inca doing their ceremonies there. In fact, when you talk to people locally, many of the Quechua speaking people here will say, oh no, these things are so much older. They were older than when our ancestors, came here and established settlements. So, and this is actually what the Spanish chroniclers actually recorded too. And they recorded that in Sacsayhuaman, they recorded that in Tiwanaku, that when they asked the locals who built Tiwanaku, the locals said, well, it wasn't us. Some of them laughed and they said, no way, we could build this. So it is in the historical records that even the people who have been here for a long time, the Amara, were saying they were much more ancient civilizations that were before their culture. So
you point out some of the shapes are so extraordinary, and the illustrations in the book really make that clear. And you'll see some of them in those of you who are watching on the video as we go along. Okay, so you'll see. But we're gonna, as we talk now, some of the older shapes will come up. And is there any why to this? Do we understand these shapes at all?
There's some theories about why you see so many knobs and what they call here intihuatanas, which are kind of the hitching posts of the sun. The theories tend to run that it's tracking solstices and equinoxes or certain significant star systems at certain times of the year. But it is kind of a puzzle because there's so many of them and they can be interpreted so many different ways. Yes. And lining up to so many constellations and phenomenon. But it does seem like some of them are actually tracking equinoxes, some of these Intihuatanas. But the interesting thing is the knobs. A lot of the knobs don't seem to have random patterns. And, some of them look like almost like a braille system. And, as far as I know, I can't figure out why some of the megaliths have them and some don't. And they don't seem to be situated where it's meant for lifting the rocks, which a lot of conventional archaeologists believe is what they were for. But they seem to be off balance from the rock. So it wouldn't be an easy thing to lift these things up as the center of balance is completely off with a lot of these knobs. So a lot of them just seem like there's a mystery, or maybe they're focusing some kind of energy on these knobs. And I actually went with a friend recently who's a sensitive up to the Moon Temple area in Sacsayhuaman. And I was watching her as she touched one of these Intihuatanas on the rock, and she actually had a shock. And she kind of jumped back and she goes, whoa. So there might be something to these being focal points of energy, and maybe people put their hands, and intentions on these stones. I would be interested, and I actually put out the word to the biogeometry community that it would be great if we actually get some people to come to Peru. Yeah. So we can actually do some study of how shapes and energies affect the human biology and the energy of the space. Because they're very connected. In
biogeometry. This is focus.
Oh, great. Wow.
Biogeometry.
Yes, I recognize
that. Samuel is very, very important to me because it helps me. These things are real. We live in in the Western world, we live in, and you can look up biogeometry and you'll find out all about it. That's not what this show is about. So we're not going to go there today. In any case, the Western mind is shrunken, literally shrunken. It is in a state of denial about what the real world is. And that has to be understood very clearly when we're talking to someone like Camille, because your Western, the prison of the Western, of Western rationality is constantly telling you, no, this can't be true, that can't be true. And it all has to be a linear progression that essentially, deeply and profoundly, makes no sense whatsoever. Right. None. Yeah. It's not real.
Yeah,
the greatest illusion we are living with now is Western rationality. But beyond that, there is a bigger rationality, stronger, more true, and actually more rational. Okay, off the hobby horse or whatever it is. Now, what about all of these sediments that are there? The whole area. You would think that there must have been a very different climate at some point there. Am I touching this correctly? I think I might be. I'm not sure. You make the point that there are so many sediments, and I thought to myself, was the weather different? like for example, the Inca period it was only so long, and yet there's so much sediment involved with these ruins, and it couldn't have all deposited in that period, could it?
Yeah, and that's the thing with the Hanampacha work. A lot of it is still under, 10, 20 meters of sediment. And, I don't know if the audience is familiar with Sacsayhuaman, but it is on a hill above Cusco. And Cusco is kind of, some of you may have heard of, is the navel of the universe in the Andean region. And navels tend to be considered as hotspots or energy centers. But anyway, Sacsayhuaman is above that, and it's kind of on a platform. And this is where you see a lot of this Hanampacha work, and you're wondering, where did the sediment come from? There are some hills around that particular area, but it doesn't seem like even with the major rains that tend to happen in the Andes, it doesn't seem like you would have this kind of a settlement buildup, which you see on these older sites. I mean, some of them are buried so deeply. And that's another thing regarding the Hanampacha work, is that it tends to be the kind of formations that you see for the cave systems, which are all over Cusco region. A lot of these go quite deep into the earth. And there was recently a study done by a geophysicist. His name was Andrei Veronov, and he had ground penetrating radar, which was over an area called Cochicancha. And basically it's an amphitheater, which is right near the colossal walls of Sacsayhuaman. And with this ground penetrating radar, they actually discovered three shafts that went down. They went down to about 30 to 40 meters. And there was really no explanation for him for these shafts. And they said they can't be natural. So it seems like somebody was building vast cave systems underneath Sacsayhuaman. There are many historical legends about cave systems which go from the Coricancha, which is the sun temple in Cusco, all the way up to Sacsayhuaman and also to Lake Titicaca. So this is a very prevalent myth. And I wouldn't even say it's a myth, because you can actually see these caves and go through some of them that aren't buried by the Ministry of Culture and the government. So
now, why does the government bury this? Why do they try so hard to conceal this? Is it that they're afraid of danger? Or?
Yes, yeah. And a number of people have been lost in them. I believe there was a team from Lima University, I think it was in the 30s, and they were exploring the cave systems. And I believe when they set out, they had, I think it was like 15 people, and only a couple of them actually came out of the cave system. So people have gotten lost. The ones that have come up, many of them have gone crazy from being underground for days at a time. The interesting thing is, it's a little bit of an aside here, is that there's a lot of people here who believe in what they call duendes, which are goblins. And if you walk around these places and you ask about these things, many people will acknowledge them and basically say that, they're here even presently. There are beings that are living underground. So, and this brings up other phenomena that we're finding here in Peru that are quite strange, like recently, the Nazca mummies are actually getting a lot of publicity, negative.
I'm heavily involved with the Nazca mummies.
Yeah.
I'm very up on that, and I'm contributing some money to another study of the mummies that's going to take place very shortly. And so, yeah, I know about the Nazca mummies, and I've thought to myself, maybe we're looking at the people who built this stuff.
Yeah, no, you know, that's, in my book, I do bring up the Lemurians and what Rudolf Steiner had witnessed in the Akashic records. And he does talk about the early Lemurians as living in caves, but that doesn't discount that other people or other forms of life are also not living underneath. And I'd like to point out, I have this great book called The Power of the Andes by Manuel Portugal. And I was really stunned to see a section here where he describes, there's an ancient lineage of keepers of wisdom here in the Andes. And they tend to be underground in Ucupacha. And he claims there's 120 civilizations that are living underground. Seems pretty incredible, but, when you notice that these chincanas or cave systems are really everywhere around here and also in Central America and probably, in Europe and Middle East, you have to wonder what's under our feet, what's underground. I just heard so many stories of people here who talk about the duendes. Some say they've seen them, I have a neighbor, his name is Jose, and he told me he was working for the Ministry of Culture on a dig in the mountains above Pisac, and he came across in a cave system a mummy. And it was only this big. And this isn't in Nazca. This is in Pisac in the Sacred Valley. And he mentioned it had an elongated head, and a stature of 1 meter. It's pretty incredible when you think about it. And he told me, the archaeologist took it down to the Garcia Losa de Vega Museum in Cusco. And I went down there. And they said, no, we don't have it. We shipped it off to the Nazca region. And I said, well.
Yeah, down to the university there. That's where
they're located. the Ica University. Yeah. And I said, well, this was a Pisac mummy. It's not from Ica. So, technically it should have stayed here in the Pisac region. But, I've recently. I took a trip to a mountain it's a little bit to the northeast of Pisac, and it looks like a pyramid. And my guide was telling me, he was from the area. He said, we frequently see duendes around here, goblins, and. He said, sometimes we see light beams up here on the mountain peak. So, just interesting stories.
Yeah. And what exactly did duendes look like?
Well,
people describe them to you.
Yeah, they're really known in the mining regions of Peru. And they tend, now I've heard stories, they're smaller than humans. In stature, and many of them have beards, which is kind of interesting. Bigger eyes, kind of more of a roundish face. We even have amusement parks here for duendes, in the Cusco area. And they're set up with kind of leprechaun-looking, dwarves and gnomes and stuff like that. So,
In Bavaria, they are known or were known in the Middle Ages as kobolds. They lived in mines. And if you look at under southern Bavaria, there is a honeycomb of tunnels that are mostly too small for people to go through that were carved by somebody. And of course, they explain them as being carved by children in the Middle Ages for reasons that are a little obscure, but there are quite a lot of them. Mm-hmm. So we could be talking about something that has been worldwide, and you have to wonder what happened, because we're not like that now. We've fallen off the path. We're not on the true human path anymore. And the result of this is we're going straight down to a situation where we have an exploding population, uncontrollable situation, economic systems that can't stop growing, that are like tumors on the planet. Mm-hmm. We're in trouble. And how in the world have we gotten there from where we were? And that gets me to the question of the vitrified forts and the vitrified stone. Can you tell us a little bit about the vitrified stone and why it might be vitrified? And also, please, what the word vitrified means.
Vitrified is kind of it's where you turn the surface material into a glass-like substance. And it usually, in reference to rock sites, it's in the case of here in Peru, it seems to be in these cave systems and grottos. And it's very shiny. It reflects the light. It seems to be applied not necessarily all over a cave, but just in certain spots on certain angles. So it's kind of a very strange phenomenon. And people haven't figured out what is the process of actually vitrifying stone inside of a cave. There's been some theories about using parabolic mirrors that would shine the light into the cave to kind of create the heat necessary. But some of this is so deep inside these caves that the light and the heat would dissipate. So it hasn't been proven that that's the way rock was vitrified. So there was a paper recently by Dejong, and I'm trying to remember the guy. But anyways, they did a study of this vitrified rock, and they found that it was composed of silica, magnesia, and aluminum, I believe. And it replicates some of the glazes in pottery that they've discovered in Argentina. But when you have like silica and magnesium, you tend to have it tends to interact with energies. I kind of speculate that this could have been used for communication by individuals who are inside the cave, because there's so much of this in these Hanampacha rock formations that, maybe this is a way in the dark, you know, when it wasn't very light, that people could communicate. But it's a very interesting phenomenon in how they did it. I think you have to have temperatures of about 2,500 degrees in order to create that.
2,500 degrees.
You know, that's an extremely high heat. So,
however they did it, it's not how we think. Mm-hmm. And incidentally, folks, there are also vitrified ruins in Scotland, in northern Scotland. So this is a worldwide phenomenon, and equally mysterious to how they generated the heat. And speaking of light and heat in caves, the caves in southern France and northern Spain, which are full of beautiful artworks, not to mention many of the subterranean remains in Egypt, there's no sign of any torch carbon anywhere. This means very simply that for a very long time, mankind could make things in places that are now dark and create enormously high temperatures without leaving any carbon deposits.
Yeah.
What happened?
It's very strange.
It's, well, what happened is we've lost something, or something has been taken.
Some technology, yeah.
You know, G.R. Gurdjieff, whose work I have studied for many years, for those of you who don't know, he was an Armenian. I guess the best way to call him would be a sort of seeker and philosopher who went across Tibet and all through that area and beyond, Afghanistan and other Kyrgyzstan and places like that, looking for answers as to the questions of the mysteries of the world. And one of the things he came up with was, at some point, something was taken from us or put into us that broke our connection with the earth. He called it the organ kunda buffer. That is to say, kundalini buffer, that buffers our connection to the planet. Mm-hmm. And we were talking, Camille and I, earlier about how the people of the past were literally much more part of the planet and have been that way since the beginning. We haven't been created. We've always been part of the planet. Consciousness has always been part of the planet. And it gradually coalesced into physical beings at probably at different times during the planet's life. But we are such beings, and we've become too dense. We're physically too dense. And this whole ideation of consciousness on Earth is going to end because of that. And it's too bad, but it just is the fact. And the next ideation is going to start differently, and it'll probably be lighter. And they'll understand. Maybe they'll even go back and repair some of these ruins.
Well, there's also theories. I'm sure you're familiar with the Anunnaki, theories of Mesopotamia and how they were doing genetic manipulation on humanity. So, you know, there may have been many multi-forms of humanity and other entities that were living with us. And if we had extraterrestrial life come in and tweak us, you know, and manipulate us. I believe there is something in the Popol Vuh, which is the book of creation from the Aztecs, that indicated that there were gods who were manipulating our genetics, and they didn't want us as smart as they were.
They weren't gods. Yeah. They were just people who we decided to call gods because we didn't understand them and saw they had great power.
Yeah.
And as you point out in the book, cargo cults did that in World War II, when they saw the amazing stuff coming out of the planes, and then after the war, they gradually gave up because it became obvious that their magic could not produce any more cases of beer because basically the Air Force was gone.
Right.
Now, if you go back to the very earliest religions that we know of, the earliest documents are in the Pyramid of Unas in Egypt. It goes back to, I think it's about 4,000 years old. And what it describes as you walk into the pyramid, the hieroglyphics describe a very different vision of the human body than we have now. And that vision is that the spine is basically an accelerator that accelerates experience that we're gathering from the physical world into the second body, into the non-physical body, which in turn delivers it to the soul, which is a very passive element in the human being, and will persist. That soul is what will persist after death, but it's not individual. It's part of a larger thing. So when my wife died, one of the first things she said was, "I'm not Anne anymore, but I will always be Anne for you." And that, I think, is what she was describing. Anyway, so we lost all of that. Now let's go on. I want to go back to some more substantive stuff, because I think I'm moving a little bit off the book. The book, by the way, is Sorcerers of Stone. It's sorcerersofstone.com. You can learn more and engage with Camille, I'm sure. And it's really fabulous and filled, packed with great illustrations. Excellent photography in the book. And it's going to get you thinking in ways that we don't think and we're not supposed to think. Well, here on this show, that's how you are supposed to think. So let's try thinking in a new way. And that said, free Dreamlanders, it's time for us to say goodbye. And we get very few subscriptions these days. And I keep on supporting the site as I always have and will do, obviously, until I can't anymore. But I would like your support and help very much. So why don't you go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe today. Just do it. And don't be passive. Something will come to you if you subscribe. Namely, access to a beautiful website with an incredible, wonderful community, social community behind it, that is not full of trolls and cruel people and fools. They're people like you, good people. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week. Subscribers, let's keep on keeping on. Camille, I want to talk about the three different styles and why they're called, identified as heaven above, heaven below, and heaven inside. I thought those were wonderful ways of describing them. Can you talk about all of the Hanapacha, Urunpacha, Ukunpacha, if I'm pronouncing these things right, and get us into that a little bit?
Yeah, that is the descriptive of Alfredo Gamarra to describe the sites that he found all around the Cusco area. And Hanapacha, he believed, was the archaeological style that was created by these more disembodied people, these more spiritualized plasticine people in the early times, which was kind of our golden era, in that, you know, people did not have war. They were basically living holistically with the environment, and they were actually one with the environment, and that they can intuit exactly what the elements were about, how to create with the natural elements. So it was a period where Alfredo kind of indicated that this was, a golden age. And the second period, which was Urunpacha, is what, most people see as the classical Inca megalithic sites that we find in Cusco, we find in Ollantaytambo, Machu Picchu. And these are where you have the polygonal rocks fitted together, and there's no mortar in between the rocks in the seams. And this is also a very puzzling time of period for people who witness this stuff, because they also don't know how they built these things, though there are some theories out there. Nobody's ever been able to replicate how they built them you know, in the real world. You know, they tried a couple times and had some had colossal failures where they had a 2-ton block and they couldn't control it and it just rolled down the mountain in Olite Tombo. So this is also a mystery period, and this looks like, according to Blavatsky, this was created by a time when Lumerian man was coming into form, and before the Atlantean period. So she tended to believe this was Lumerian of a very advanced form in the later Lumerian epoch. So the third form, Ukupacha, is the architectural style that we see of the Inca, the Kilke, also the Wari. And these are the later cultures that were inhabiting the Cusco region. And basically, it's distinguished by the types of rocks, which aren't as pretty as the megalithic. They also tend to be built with smaller rocks with mortar in between, and much more rustic than the megalithic Urampacha style. The previous, the heaven above style, tends to be even, it's a little more Dr. Seussian. It's more playful. It's more, it's not really designed as we would envision normal types of temples or buildings for living in. And this is why it seems like it's built of a different mind, and whether this is the early Lumerian mind or some other entity that's living underground, it's kind of hard to say. But the fact that we see this Hanampacha style like literally everywhere, and we find it under the temple of it's called the foundation stone in the temple of the rock in Jerusalem. You find it there. You find it under the Acropolis. A lot of the major sites, including the Giza pyramids, you'll find these subterranean chambers, which have this kind of rock. So that's the real puzzling thing. Is like, what culture created this, and why did we find it all around the world?
It was worldwide. The knowledge was worldwide.
Yeah, exactly.
And deep, you know, folks, most people don't know this, but the latitude that the Great Pyramid is on is the same number as the speed of light. They knew a lot. And things are, the world's full of amazing stuff like this, like the mala, which is the thing that the Hindus use to pray with. It's 108 beads on a mala. And that number, 108, multiplied in various ways, leads to the distance between the earth and the moon, the diameter of the sun, the diameter of the earth, all kinds of things like that. Contained in the number 108 is the whole design of the solar system. The mala is thousands of years old. It comes from this period. And we're looking at a world that I don't think was destroyed so much as departed. Or was it destroyed, Camille? What do you think happened?
I think this knowledge still exists, actually, but I think it's hidden, and it's hidden for a good reason. I think the, I don't really want to blame Catholics or anything like that, but the, Roman Catholic Church really restricted a lot of esoteric knowledge from humanity, and they, they did so through inquisitions and burning libraries and, When they came over to Central America and South America, they set to destroying the Huacas, and they set to destroying the ancient knowledge, including the priests who lived in all over South and Central America. They wanted to destroy the tradition and lineage of this, you know, these cultures who really could communicate with, you know, transdimensional worlds and knew the divinity that was within them. And you saw this with what happened to the Cathars as well in the south of France, who were
Knights Templar.
In the Templar, yes. Yeah, and they were teaching a form of knowing yourself and inner divinity, which you didn't need a priest class to interpret or to give you the pass to heaven, right? You can get that pass to heaven within yourself through certain.
That's why they were destroyed.
That's why they were destroyed, right?
Because they respected the power and integrity of the individual human being.
To gain
access to his own spiritual or her own spiritual truth,
mm-hmm.
on their own.
Yes, exactly.
The truth is, there's not one path or 10 paths. Every single mm-hmm. one of us is a path to total and complete consciousness, at least potentially, every
right.
one of us.
Exactly. And it seems like this knowledge was, you know, the authorities wanted to keep this knowledge secret, I guess, to in a way to keep a monopoly on this wisdom that came from way back.
To control others. I mean, it's mm-hmm. it's all about a great sickness, which is the urge to control the lives of others.
Yeah.
And
to keep us from really knowing our powers, our,
yes.
you know, we can transcend from this body into a more spiritual being and life, and to know, you know, our higher dimensional selves. So, I mean, I guess that, you know, the church and the empire really, you know, really wanted their slaves, basically.
Right.
And they wanted to keep us under control, so we didn't. So they were the arbiters of this particular power themselves. So, and I do believe, like, the library in the Vatican is probably extremely vast, and I really wish they would open that up so we
see. I happen to have a friend who's got a very high clearance, and he can go to parts mm-hmm. of the Vatican Library with his security clearance that no one even knows exist. There is a profound connection between mm-hmm. the American intelligence community and the Vatican. They are joined at the hip, and it is very secret and private, but it's true. It's true.
Yeah.
And that, the fact that, and I've said to him, frankly, you know, it's incredibly evil what you're doing. And it's incredibly evil, and you don't see that. And that means mm-hmm. that you have to pay for this after you die. You will pay mm-hmm. all of them. All mm-hmm. of the people keeping the secrets are actually captured by an engine that destroys mm-hmm. souls and uses their energy. And when these mm-hmm. people die with all of their security clearances and all of their secrets, it turns out that they are food for something. And mm-hmm. those of us who have tried to fight that and have tried to bring the human soul into a new level of independence and truth are the opposite. We go in the opposite direction.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's a time, really, we need to you know, this material really needs to come out, how we can
desperately needs to come out
because transcend this material realm, and ascend basically is what we need to do as a humanity. And
human freedom depends mm-hmm. on mm-hmm. coming out, and this is one of the ways that we can ascend, because the energies are still there right. in Cuzco, mm-hmm. all over the world, in any of these sacred sites, mm-hmm. you can find these energies, mm-hmm. and you can find them in many, many places. And if you know what you're doing, you can use them. You know, I want to, before we go, and we're getting kind of close-ish to the end, I want to you to talk about Amaru Muru, which you sent me a video of earlier today. Talk about that, because it's the right time to talk about it when we're talking about ascension.
Tell us
what it is, and tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, that was a interesting video that a friend sent to me. It was a story of Jerry Wills, who basically had gone to Amaru Muru, which is very close to Lake Titicaca. The lake has receded over centuries, but it used to be right on top of the lake. But anyways, there's a portal there, and it's in this red kind of sandstone rock formation. And he describes like meeting this Amara man in Aguas Caliente below Machu Picchu. And I guess they developed a great friendship, and he told him something about this area and how to use it. Basically, I kind of feel funny about saying this online because I don't think really people should be experimenting with it unless they really know what they're doing. But there's a foam, like tones you can use to actually use this portal. It was November 11th, 1998. He and his wife went down there, and they decided to see if these tones would work. He was very surprised to find out that they actually did. And he ended up in a wormhole and was transported into what he says was a white room. He noticed there was a floor, but all around him was just white. He hears a voice, and this voice says, "Oh, what are you doing here?" He says, "Well, this is how I got here, by using these tones through this portal. And were you the ones who made this portal?" And the voice that came back said, "Yes, we made these portals, and we have them all around the world." Listening to him, he didn't strike me as being particularly a charlatan or somebody creating a story. It seemed like he was really scared, and he wanted to get out of there, and he wanted to come back to Earth. And so he says, "Okay, you know, I really need to get back." He just got married to his wife, Kathy. And I really want to get back to my marriage.
Right.
And his wife actually describes him coming through this portal as the light body. So when she saw him leave through the portal, she saw him, his body turned into a light body. And when he did come back, he also, she saw the same phenomenon. So, and then he materialized and he fell back to the ground and I guess was very thankful to be back on Earth. But he, Very crazy story.
Well, it's actually not a crazy story to me because I've had the same experience, not there, but elsewhere.
Yeah.
And here's the most important part of the story, folks. We are light bodies. That's mm-hmm. what we are. Mm-hmm. We are light bodies slowed down by the weight of gravity and the density of the atmosphere of this planet as it is now. And I have to tell you that beyond that room, that isn't a room, it's a barrier. Beyond that room is a whole world of the most, to glimpse it leaves you with the most sense of deep, poignant longing that you have to live with from then on. And it's a hard thing to come back here and to know you could go. But of course, I got punished because I did things. I was told not to go. And of course, I went anyway. And what do they expect of me? They must know me well enough to know that when I'm, I'm going to go where I'm not wanted. That's just my nature. Anyway, it is a real place, believe you me. And in fact, I talk about it a lot in my book, A New World, about the experience of going there at the Lakota Sioux Reservation in South Dakota. And here, right here where I live, there's a place nearby where I can go there. I've taken many people and they can't go there. They can't make it work, but I can, for some unknown reason. Okay, well, let's go. We're getting sort of close to the end of the show. Let's talk about Cusco and the Bible land of Cus and the map of Ptolemy, because I want to dimensionalize things a little bit and try to get our heads around the fact that humanity once had a different vibration, a higher vibration. And when we had this higher vibration, all of these mysterious ruins made sense to us because we built them. And maybe since at that level of vibration, there's no real, it's not like people from another planet or there's only one consciousness and it can materialize in many different forms. So we weren't alone here, really. Tell us about the land of Cus and Cusco and the possibility that the authors, some of the authors of the Bible knew about this, about Cusco.
Boy, I think that's in the book. I don't know if I wrote about that, but.
Yeah, you did.
I did? Okay.
Yes, you did.
Well, the one thing I know for sure, when you call a place a navel, and this is a description of like a energy source that is electromagnetic energy force. And they're all throughout the world, basically. But here in the Andes, Cusco is kind of at the center of all of that. And you also have a temple called the Temple of the Sun or the Coricancha, which is, and it radiates what they call Sique lines out across the whole region of the Cusco Andean mountain range. So there's like 43 Siques, and on each of these Siques, there's a number of very powerful wakas or sacred sites. And this is where the priest class would often go and have, use these wakas as like oracles, interacting with other dimensions. Chroniclers call them power spots. So the whole Andean region is actually kind of known for that. Like in this range of mountain systems and in the jungles, like a Patiti, there's known as an energy phenomenon which can be detected from space. And there's a lot of electrons in the mountain ranges and geomagnetic forces. So And that might be the reason why there are so many wakas here around Cusco. Because I think there's more of them, you know, per square mile than really anywhere in the world. Maybe Egypt might be the exception, but you know, there are sites not only in Cusco but in the surrounding regions of Chinchero, Ollantaytambo, Machu Picchu. So it might be that these mountain ranges and the fault systems are creating, energetic hotspots all throughout the Andes, and telluric currents are flowing and vortexes. Yeah. So, this is probably why Cus, is considered a sacred site for many of the Andean brotherhoods here. They have the Brotherhood of the Sun Disc.
In Bible studies that the land of Cush is Nubia, excuse me.
Nubia, okay.
Yeah, but...
That would be Africa.
It would be Africa, because the name is similar to Kusk, the Egyptian word for Nubia, but at the same time, it's also similar to the word Cusca, and of course, the people studying the Bible couldn't imagine the idea that there might be some connection between the those two distant places. It's just it's incomprehensible to them. I wanted to bring it up because the land of Cush is a sort of a settled thing in the Bible, and I want to suggest maybe it shouldn't be settled. Maybe there's more to it than that.
That was one of the theories with Jesus Gamarra, which was Alfredo's son. He, in his book Parawaso, he also believes that Cusco was a central biblical region. It would seem like we didn't have the boundaries that we've drawn up today to delineate cultures and epics in history. It seems like sometime in the past, the world there was a worldwide culture who were communicating with one another. So, and maybe they use these sacred sites as the way to communicate, through energy vortexes and, other electromagnetic, and consciousness connecting across continents.
Yeah, because consciousness actually is an energy vortex, but it's just so diminished in power that it doesn't feel like anything to us.
Yeah.
We think it, if you look at modern neurological science, it's all devoted to the idea that consciousness is somewhere inside the head and nowhere else. Mm-hmm. But when you really work with this, you find your head is somewhere inside consciousness, which is everywhere else.
Yeah, so, yeah, exactly.
I want to read a quote, a fascinating quote in the book. I'd like to discuss its meaning. This is from the Zend Avesta, Vendidad Farugad 2, verses 18 to 19. And Camille will explain that to us shortly, I hope. Then Yima stepped forward toward the luminous space southward to meet the sun, and pressed the earth with the golden ring and bored it with the pointard, speaking thus: O earth, kindly open asunder and stretch thyself afar to bear flocks and herds and men. And Yima made the earth grow larger by 3/3 than it was before. And there came flocks and herds and men at his will and wish, as many as he wished. And what I saw there is a description of a technology being used to create life here.
So that's interesting.
About that quote.
I wouldn't know exactly how the technology would work, but let's say there's magic.
I just about the origin of the quote and what the Zenda Vesta is.
Yeah, that's a it's a Persian ancient text of the Zoroastrian tradition, and it's their creation myth, basically. So it gives the cosmogony of how the earth was created, how humans were created, and many such other creation myths around the world. But this particular quote was to give some weight to the idea of Alfredo Gamarra's theory that the earth had seen three different sizes. And, and I was really surprised to find that quote. and I believe it was also in the Hebrew tradition where they also speak about the earth growing threefold as well. And that also started in the Ibn Harisha, or that was the foundation stone, which is under the Dome of the Rock. And that earth was called, God was called to expand the earth threefold.
Exactly.
So, it was very interesting to find that in, ancient origin text, that would seem to corroborate what Alfredo Gamarra was indicating about our early earth and its growth. So,
the paper we referred to earlier, the Noel paper, is very interesting. And it's not some airy-fairy thing at all, folks. It could be that this planet, it did expand. And, of course, then there is the something that's not mentioned in the book that Camille and I discussed in email, the great nonconformity, which is the fact that there is a billion-year gap between the Precambrian and the Cambrian that nobody ever talks about. There's no sediments there. And if you look into theories about it, the main theory is that for a billion years, Earth was made of ice. But here's the problem. When the ice melted, where did the material that's there now that we call the world come from? If it didn't exist before, where was it? So something is off. We've got a planet that in and of itself can't be explained. We can't be explained. The planet can't be explained. And Camille is here to help us. Go ahead.
Yeah, right. Well, I was just wondering about that because that was the first time I heard about it when you sent me that email. But I was just wondering if in fact there was a solid Earth underneath an Earth that was covered with ice. So if maybe we had at some time in history, Cambrian history, I believe, that we had an extended, ice age period. I can't imagine a billion years, but maybe that's possible. Maybe
here's the problem with that. Mm-hmm. There can't have been anything under the ice. Mm-hmm. The reason is that that would have been, if the ice had all melted, that would now have been visible as a sediment layer, and it's not. There's a gap between the an enormous gap in the time zone, in the timeline between the two levels. And there's nothing to explain it. I've often thought to myself, maybe it was just scraped off and the whole thing was rebuilt with the material was recycled. And what we're looking at when we see this expansion of the earth is a technology so extraordinary that it completely recreated the planet. It's just
some of the Bible texts actually describe entities coming down and terraforming, and there was already an earth here, but something had happened, and the Bible describes it as being a very dark earth with waters, and there was some Elohim that came down, and they ended up using their you know, I guess spaceships, which could create massive hurricane whirlwinds, which actually cleared the water from the land on the higher parts. That those are some of the biblical texts, which so yeah. It seems that there was some terraforming that was happening in the ancient past. So maybe we had these visitors who really, you know, there was some catastrophe and they helped rebuild the earth. Perhaps this was at that Cambrian period as well, or shortly after. So that's, you know, all we can do is really speculate about that.
We're helpless in a sense that we can do no more than speculate. But yet there's a guidance from people like Steiner and Blavatsky that you can find in yourself a great deal of knowledge, because we have that knowledge buried in us. The knowledge, the whole knowledge. Remember that the consciousness was born with the planet. This ideation of consciousness, I should say, was concentrated around this planet when it was born. And we've been part of this forever. And to the way to higher consciousness is to really learn how to reconnect yourself with your planet, reconnect yourself with your earth. That's why all of these ruins cannot be understood now, because we are disconnected from the earth. And therefore, we are disconnected from the reality of physics. We live with a false physics, a physics of illusion. Hindu mythology has a great idea of Maya's palace, a palace of illusion and mirrors.
Right.
This is all about this show, this particular program, all about escaping Maya's palace. And what do you find when you escape Maya's palace? Fantastic, wonderful ruins of an unknown world that was greater than this. You know, Camille, I have to thank you for being with us. And is there anything else you'd like to talk about before we go? Because we're kind of getting up to the end of the show.
I would just like to say, I hope people can visit these sites because I do think, you know, they can get a lot out of them if they spend some time with them and sit with them and meditate. And I've frequently had some very profound, you know, experiences when I was there and very healing energy that comes from them. And sometimes you do have outer body experiences. Sometimes you have contact with higher dimensions. And I think, you know, I think Freddie Silva brings this up in his books a lot. These are places we can go to get rejuvenated and to reconnect again with our higher self, the earth, Pachamama, and really learn from her and learn about ourselves as well. So we can get connected again with the cosmos, the earth, and our, you know, our higher self. So I would love to just recommend people go to these places and do a pilgrimage. And
I've got a lot of reasons to go to Cusco, and they're building up, so I'm probably going to come soon.
Oh, that'd be great.
Because I'm working with the mummies, and I'd like to be down there a little bit, and I'd love to meet you and go out to some of the places.
Oh, I would love that. Yeah.
Yeah, that would be really fun.
Let's plan on that.
Yeah, let's try to plan on that, make that happen soon. Listen, the other thing is, what is it? Oh, yeah. The book will be out on May the 21st. I've already got a copy pre-ordered, paid for. They give you a PDF when you do an interview. I bought the book. And that's fairly unusual for me. But folks, go to Amazon and do a pre-order on it, because that really helps the book. And it is a book that deserves to be helped. It's wonderful and very, very mind-opening. So, Camille, what a find. I'm so glad that Inner Traditions and Manzanilla Carpenter
thank you. Who
calls herself the Manzaniac, their publicist, brought you to my attention. It has been an absolutely delightful show. Her website is sorcerersofstone.com. The book, Sorcerers of Stone. Don't miss it.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Whitley. It was wonderful to be on your program.
Yeah, it was great fun, wasn't it? I had a blast. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.